Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Good evening. This is The Interpreter Radio Show, and we're expecting the radio to break back in about 60 seconds.
Yeah, I was saying, don't jump the gun. Don't jump the gun.
But I'm just going to kill time here until that happens. I just didn't want there to be dead air.
Okay.
How are you this evening, Mike?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you. Or maybe not. Who knows? It's kind of a potpourri, really. You know, you roll the dice and see what happens.
Yeah, pretty much every time I assume it's not going to happen. Yeah. But of course, now that I'm assuming it's happening, it's not happening. So let me start by welcoming you to the Interpreter Radio Show, put on by the Interpreter Foundation, a nonprofit educational organization focused on the scriptures of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, early LDS history, and related subjects. The Interpreter Radio Show is sponsored by LDSAgents.com, a network of over 3,000 friendly, top-quality real estate agents, serving Latter-day Saints nationwide and in Canada for more than 20 years. Whether you're buying or selling your home, be in touch with LDSAgents.com. Their professional, friendly real estate agents will help you to find just the home you're looking for that meets your needs in a safe neighborhood with the right schools and a temple not far away. Now it's easy to find a real estate agent who speaks your language and shares your values. Wherever you are or wherever you're going, let LDSAgents.com reduce the stress of your move. That's LDSAgents.com. And, of course, this is the one time when it didn't break in. Okay, let's get on to the Come Follow Me lesson. The lesson is for, I think, the last week in February. It covers Genesis 24 through 27.
We might want to mention that Chris is off.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry, yes. I'd like to excuse Chris Fredrickson. She's dealing with illness in the family and regrets not being here, but she has more important things to attend to. Our prayers and thoughts go out to her. Okay, let's talk about this. This is, in effect, the story of Isaac, which doesn't occupy much space. Now, we always say, you know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob will become known as Israel. And Isaac is sort of the
middle child,
non-entity. I mean, he's almost a placeholder between Abraham and Israel, and I don't mean that disparagingly, but what we have here,
yeah, we get the little fewest amount of, or the smallest amount of information about it. And one thing that's interesting is that we talk about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob all practicing plural marriage, but there's no scriptural record of Isaac being married to any other woman besides Rebecca.
That's actually very true. And even with that, with Rebecca, well, I don't want to jump the gun too much. Okay, so Abraham's, you know, Sarah is dead. Abraham's nearing the end of his life, and he calls his servant into him and says, go find my son a wife among my kindred. Says, I don't want him marrying one of the Canaanites here. And this is going to be an ongoing theme through most of the history of Israel.
Yeah.
But he says, swear to me that you will go back to the land I left, to my father's house, and of my kindred, find a wife. And if you can find her, and if she will come, that's fine. If she won't come, then you've fulfilled your obligation. And there's probably, Abraham's may not entirely be sure whether or not he's going to live long enough to see the wife come back. So that's where we start, and I'm gonna punt it over to you, Mike, because I've been talking.
Yeah, well, there's three really interesting things in the first nine verses of chapter 24, at least interesting to me. One of them is that verse 2, Abraham said unto his eldest servants that ruled over his house, this is probably Eleazar, this is back in Genesis 15, verse 2, Abraham had complained to God that he didn't have any children, and that this slave that he had, Eleazar, was going to inherit everything. So that's probably who he's talking to here. But he says to his most trusted servant, put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh. And we see that same thing in verse 9, where the servant puts his hand under his thigh. Now, there's probably a euphemism going on in here. This is a bit of an odd one that I think a lot of people are going to be, if they know what's going on here, they're kind of turned off by this. So notice that the servant in verse 9, he puts his hand under the thigh of Abraham, and he swore to him concerning that matter. So he makes an oath. And verse 3 tells us that that oath is made in the name of Jehovah, the God of heaven, and the God of earth. You know, this is a very solemn oath. When you swear by the life of something, that's a very solemn oath in the ancient world. If you swear by the life of God, it's the most solemn oath that you can make. And no one would ever dare violate that, would ever take an oath and not... and not perform it. And so this is underscoring how important this is to Abraham. It's, you know, don't allow my son Isaac to take a wife of the Canaanites. This is going to destroy everything that I've done. Instead, go back to my family in Haran and find him a wife among my kinship. It's something I'll come back to in a second. So the servant puts his hand under the thigh of Abraham, and probably what is happening here is that the servant is actually holding, if I could just be blunt here, is actually holding Abraham's genitalia as he makes this oath. Now, to us, that is something that is completely, are you joking? You know, no one in our modern world would ever do that. But remember, this oath is being made by the life of something, and there is nothing more symbolic of the Abrahamic covenant than, remember Abraham, the whole center of the Abrahamic covenant is that Abraham is going to have descendants as numerous as the sands of the sea or the stars in the sky. And that is, of course, the source of all of those things. And so for his servant to hold his master in that way underscores how serious this is. This actually shows up later in the Old Testament, in Genesis 47:29, where Jacob and his son Joseph do the same thing. Now, I think the common response here from a lot of Latter-day Saints is, well, the Joseph Smith translation of Genesis 24, verses 2 and 9, changes thigh to hand. Put your hand over my hand. I would, fully admit that, but I don't think that that was an original reading that Joseph was restoring. I think what he was doing was amending it for Western readers, so that Western readers would go, oh, okay, I guess there's something going on here. The interesting thing is that the Joseph Smith translation does not change Genesis 47:29, which seems to indicate that Joseph Smith either overlooked it or, you know, there's a deeper thing going on here. The second thing of the three that I wanted to mention here is, here we have an example of kinship marriage. This is not something that we practice today. In fact, kinship marriage is highly discouraged today. You can't marry someone who is a first cousin in most states, and the states that do allow it, including Utah, you have to be of an age where you can't bear children, so there's, you know, concerns about that sort of thing. But again, this is a very different world that they lived in. Kinship marriage, very, very common in the ancient world, still common today in some societies. And the reasoning here, I think, resonates with Latter-day Saints, is that we've been taught to marry and raise children in the covenant. And Abraham is worried that Isaac is going to take a wife of the Canaanites and violate the covenant or bring an end to it. And so go back to my family here. And the third issue is arranged marriage. That's another custom that's foreign to us. Today, we marry for love. But, you know, that's a relatively modern notion. Historically, most marriages, and today in the world, still many of them, are political, financial, religious arrangements between families, and the couple themselves have little to no say in the matter. So we shouldn't be surprised at all to see Isaac, you know, a man of, you know, 2000 BC or thereabouts, being married off to a woman to whom he was related, but to whom he had never met and had no say in the matter. That, you know, the day that he met her was the day that they got married.
Those are all great, great observations.
There's a lot going on in here. It's kind of under the surface that we just don't usually pick up on. Or if we do pick up, they go, oh, that's weird, and we move on. But, yeah.
well, these set of chapters through here, and basically you're going to see Isaac's story repeated with Jacob to a certain extent. Some additional twists, and we'll get into that. This is the core. We talk about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or Abraham. Actually, we always say Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So Jacob is renamed Israel. That's where the 12 tribes of Israel are. And the as per your point, it's very interesting. Abraham has two sons, Ishmael and Isaac, both of whom are discussed in these chapters. And they both are to become great nations. Ishmael has 12 sons. Isaac just has the one. Or actually, excuse me, Isaac has the two. And you're going to get the same division with Isaac. And I'm getting a little ahead of myself with Jacob and Esau that you sort of have with Ishmael and Isaac. So you see this pattern replicating itself. And this is the foundation. These chapters through here are the foundation of not just the Abrahamic covenant, but the Abrahamic religions. And you have Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, which all identify themselves as being descended from Abraham and as having the blessing of God, and in essence, all of them competing, each of them asserting that this is based on the covenants that God made with Abraham. Interesting the impact or shape that has. Now, let me address another thing in the chapter here that's often common. In fact, Alter mentions it in his translation of the Hebrew Bible, is the mention of camels. And it's often pointed out, well, there's no evidence of camels being bred in Canaan at the time of the patriarchs, which is true, though you still have to ask the question of what camel bones you'd find. But Abraham gets his camels from Egypt, very specifically saying that the Pharaoh sent him asses and camels. And Egypt did, in fact, have domesticated camels at this time. And I simply mentioned that if someone tries to say, this is proof that the Bible is ahistorical, as Mike and I will often talk about. We have a lot of historical issues with the Bible. That said, at least to the interpretation of the Bible. That said, my advice is don't get hung up on the camels thing, because they're and it's what's also interesting is that the whole discussion of camels tends to go away by the time you're into the Israel and his sons, because when they go down to Egypt, they don't go on camels, they go on asses, which were common and were domesticated. So the camels sort of show up here and then they disappear again.
and we should be note that not everything in here, remember, this is being written for an audience that comes much later.
Yeah.
And so there are probably, and almost certainly, liberties have been taken with the historical record, shall we say.
Oh, yeah.
To, and so this would appeal to an audience reading it in 600 BC, 500 BC, something like that. And we're going to see this in chapter 26, where Isaac is having disagreements with his neighbors over these various wells, and he keeps naming these wells and giving them Hebrew names. Well, remember, this is 2000 BC, and Hebrew doesn't exist in 2000 BC. It doesn't come around for another 1,000 years. So it, clearly, you can't give a Hebrew name to a well before Hebrew exists as a language. It's being written for a different audience, so the audience knows. But like Bruce said, don't get hung up on, well, you know, there weren't any domesticated camels. Okay. Does it really matter to the story? The fact is that you had a servant that goes to Haran, and maybe he had camels. Okay. Maybe he didn't. Maybe it's, you know, whatever.
Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. It's not important.
Not important to the story. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, the stories follow such patterns that they're clearly archetypes that are being presented. So you have the servant, Eleazar, we assume, who travels to the city of Nahor, and we have the watering motif that has shown up time and again. It shows up with Moses. It's going to show up here, though. In this case, it's the young woman who's going to be doing the watering. And Eleazar makes this interesting thing. He says, "Okay, Lord," and what's interesting is how human this sounds. He's like, "Okay, I'm here. I have no idea. I'm going to find a wife for Jacob, for Isaac." Let's have it be, if I ask her for a drink, she'll give me a drink and also offer to give water to my camels. And it's that last part that's pretty significant. You know, getting a drink of water yourself is not a big deal. Watering camels is a lot of work. For her to say, "Oh yes, I'll water your camels also." So he's putting a challenge to the Lord and saying, "Yeah, this is what I want for a sign." And of course, Rebecca comes and she's beautiful. She's unmarried. She's virgin, and she says, "Sure, I'll give you something to drink." And she gets water and gives it to him to drink. And then, as Alter points out, you have sort of this delicious pause, and then she says, "Oh, and I'll water your camels too." And waters them, and Eleazar is like, "Oh, thank you, Lord. you've answered my prayer. This is this faith promoting story for a fast and testimony meeting." and there I was, and she not only gave me the drink, she watered the camels as well. It's interesting to note that he actually gives her a nose ring and some bracelets, and then says, "Oh, by the way, who's your father?" It's like, here's this beautiful woman. She's answered this, you know, and it's like, I'm bringing these gifts, and then it's like he suddenly realizes, wait, I still have to find out whether or not she's related to Abraham, and asks, "Who's your father?" And she says, "Oh yes, I'm the daughter of Bethuel, and son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother." And so he's doubly relieved. It's like this is his faith promoting story. The Lord miraculously intervened, led him to the right well. Of course, we don't know whether or not he stopped at two or three other wells along the way. if he did, he probably didn't answer, you know, or he didn't bother to record that. It's just when he comes to the right one and finds the right young woman.
What's interesting to me about the gifts that he gives her, you mentioned the nose ring. The King James just says a ring, but the Hebrew is a little bit more specific. In there. Also, two gold bracelets that weighed about 4 ounces of gold, mm-hmm. And jewels of silver, jewels of gold, clothing. He gives all this stuff to Rebecca. These represent what was called the term for this as a bride price. So when you take a woman away from her family, a young unmarried woman, you're not just taking the woman, you're taking her labor, because she provides a benefit to the family by, for example, going down and drawing water from the well. Well, if you take her away, someone else has got to do that, and you've got to pay someone to do it. And so that's what these gifts are designed to do, is to compensate her family for the loss of her labor. That sounds kind of mercenary to us. Again, we don't do that here in the Western world, but it's still very common in parts of the world today, in the Far East and parts of Africa, still do it. And here's the fun part. Latter-day Saints are probably best acquainted with this practice from the 1969 film Johnny Lingo, where the hero offers the unheard-of bride price of 8 cows for Mahana's hand in marriage. You know, this is how much he values her, and of course that's what the cows are designed to do, is to compensate her father, because she can no longer now provide labor in their family. She's now part of Johnny Lingo's family, and the same thing is happening here. So that this world that we're talking about operated under kind of different rules than we're used to. They didn't have women who graduated from high school and then went out to college by themselves and then were professionals working in you know, careers, and then meeting a man and deciding to get married together because they were in love. I mean, all of that would be just completely foreign to these people. That's just not the way it worked.
Yeah. And you know, and your important point is that's still the way much of the world operates. There's, we've talked before on the show of sort of the first world Mormonism. The you know, middle class to middle upper class Mormon population in the United States. And among those there are often certain expectations. Of course, this is how everything is, and we tend to back project our cultural norms on people in the scriptures. And frankly, in many cases, we project it back on 18th or 19th century Latter-day Saints and find grounds to criticize as a result of that.
Yeah.
Anyway,
we may need to move forward on. We're still in 24, yeah. And we're almost,
yes.
Almost 7:30.
We're about halfway through the hour. Okay, moving on.
Maybe I can grab something kind of interesting here toward the end of the chapter.
Yep.
Verse 54. Rebecca's family wants her to remain with them for 10 more days, but Abraham's servant wants to leave immediately. Remember, he's under covenant. He's under oath here to get this woman as quickly as possible back to Abraham, his master. And so Rebecca's family, they ask her, you know, what are your wishes? And she just simply says, I will go. She's, you know, she has no idea who this person is, but she has complete faith that she's doing the right thing. And I love this passage toward the end of the chapter in verse 60. So her family, she's leaving her family. And keep in mind that her family, I mean, they don't have the internet and phones. And there's not even a postal service. They will likely never see her again for the rest of their lives. And so they bless her before she leaves. And I love the blessing that's in here. It is so Old Testament. It is so perfect for that time and place, and yet it still kind of resonates with us. In verse 60, they bless Rebecca and said unto her, thou art our sister. Be thou the mother of thousands of millions, and let thy seed, your descendants, possess the gate of those which hate them. Or in other words, may your descendants possess the strongholds, the castles and fortifications of their enemies. In other words, triumph over all of their enemies. Become the mother of, you know, tens of millions and conquer all your enemies. You know, and we've got a daughter in our house who, she's our youngest, and she's been accepted to a university here in Utah, and she's going to be going off in about 6-7 months. And I kind of, you know, I understand this concept. It's like, go out and be successful.
Yeah.
Be the best you. And not only that, inherit all the blessings. The beautiful blessing. I absolutely love verse 60 in that chapter.
And the chapter ends. Rebecca comes back with Eleazar. And basically, as you said, marries Isaac, and it says, yeah, he was consoled after his mother's death. Now, the interesting thing that we're going to find out here, in 25 we can, well, actually there's one item in 25 that I'm interested in. But with the blessing that she's given on her departure, she's actually not going to bear children for 20 years.
Yeah.
It's going to be 20 years before she has twins. And as you said, there's no indication that Isaac had other wives or concubines, which is interesting, and it may be a reflection of his devotion to her and of his faith that the Lord would actually honor the promises made to Abraham and through him to Isaac. Chapter 25, and we're down to about 20 minutes left. We talk about the death of Abraham. We talk about the lineage of Isaac. Oh, no, I was getting ahead of myself. Thinking of chapter 26. Okay, so.
Yeah, Abraham dies.
Yes, this is where things start to get really interesting.
Yeah. So it's after he marries like six different women in his old age, and, you know, they're bearing all these children that go off to become, you know, ancestors of related tribes and so forth.
Yeah. So, after 20 years, Rachel gets pregnant, and feels
only after Isaac prays.
Yes, yes.
He prays to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer.
And she says that she somehow feels that she's bigger than usual. It's like, what's going on in here in my womb? Why am I going through this? And ask the Lord, why is there this conflict? Why this is not how I see all the other women do it. The Lord tells her, two nations will come out of your loins, and the elder will be the younger one's slave or servant. And we have the first one born, who's Esau, red and hairy, and then Jacob comes out while holding on, basically his hand is holding on to Esau's heel. And they're born, and we get this dichotomy between the two. You have Esau, who is a man of the field, skilled in hunting, and you have Jacob, who is a simple man, a dweller in tents. So you've got the division I'm looking for. Basically, you have the division, not unlike the way the Book of Mormon writers tend to paint the divisions between the Lamanites and the Nephites. You've got those who live in the field, who hunt, who are a wild man, and you have those who live in the cities or in the tents, raise crops and so on. And you have this division. Esau is Isaac's favorite. Jacob is Rachel's favorite. And then we have the famous thing where, as adult men, Jacob has prepared a stew. Esau comes to the field and was famished. And says, and I like Alter's translation, let me gulp down some of this red stuff. Where I am famished. And Alter says that the Hebrew here tends to indicate that Esau is being portrayed as sort of less educated, less couth. Jacob says, well, sell me your birthright. And Esau says, oh, what good is it going to do me? I'm going to starve to death. Sure, you have my birthright. And it says he sold his birthright, and then Jacob gave Esau bread and little stew, and he ate and drank. And Robert Alter points out that the verb there, the Hebrew verb for he ate, shows up later in Hebrew as the verb that describes how animals feed. So there's a whole subtext here of sort of Esau being unarticulate, uneducated, almost less civilized, if you will. You know, I want that red stuff. I'm going to gobble it down. And Jacob takes advantage and says, yeah, sell me your birthright. And Esau's like, I don't care. And so that's how.
Well, and it continues with this next little passage where Esau marries two Hittite women, and you know this shows that it's that he despises his birthright, and not despise in the sense of I hate it, but he just doesn't care. You know, Esau is just kind of doing whatever he feels like in the moment. And I really think that the story here is portraying him perhaps in a negative light, but it just kind of shows that, you know what, he's not thinking ahead. He's not valuing the things that Abraham and Isaac valued, and certainly not what the readers value. And I think if you're a reader in ancient Israel reading this, that you're catching on real quick that, you know, this guy is not, he's not fit for it. And so we got to figure out a way to get the birthright over to Jacob, which is that's how the story continues in a bit.
And it continues the motif that we keep seeing, which is the younger favored over the elder. So you have Isaac favored over Ishmael. You have Jacob favored over Esau. We'll eventually see in the Book of Mormon Nephi favored over all three of his older brothers.
Well, there's four generations here. Abraham is not the oldest in his family.
Yeah.
So Abraham, and he gets and then Isaac, Jacob, and then Joseph is the same way.
Yeah.
That fourth generation, he's not the oldest, and he gets the birthright. And then you go down that fifth generation. It's between Manasseh and Ephraim.
Yep.
And Jacob, when he blesses them, he switches his hands. Yep. And Joseph tries to say, "Wait a minute, Dad," and he goes, "No, I know what I'm doing here." So this is a repeating motif. It's very interesting to me, and we see the same thing with multiple generations of women who can't bear children.
Yeah.
Sarah is the first one, and then you get Rebecca, and then Jacob is going to be married to multiple women, but his beloved Rachel, she doesn't bear until much later in life, and dies in childbirth with her second child. So these themes keep coming up. It's really, really interesting.
A brief thing on chapter 26 here is you have sort of a repeating of the same story that Abraham and Sarah went through, except it's Isaac and Rachel, and they're with Abimelech, and once again says, you know, tell them you're my sister. But you have, rather than having dreams or angels or anything, you have Abimelech look out the window, and he sees Isaac sporting with Rachel.
Yeah, sporting. That's the weirdest word. King James, go for it. Yeah.
They're
making out, basically. They're getting
some sort of affection there that is not particularly appropriate between a brother and sister. And once again, you have the, you know, someone here might have lightly lain with thy sister and caused a problem. So you have the motif. And then you have a falling out between them and Abimelech, and they keep moving till they finally get far enough away. And then you have the Lord appearing to Isaac and basically renewing the same covenant he has for Abraham. And then it ends, as you said, at the very end. Esau is like, yeah, I'm taking. Really, it's interesting because they're talking here about Esau being 40 years old. Well, this is the same, literally the same time when Jacob marries Rebecca. Isaac marries Rebecca. I keep getting ahead of myself here. When Esau is 40, Never mind what I'm saying. Esau
getting married.
So now we're in chapter 27. And this is the great conundrum. Okay, what's the you have? And there's something that struck me listening to it. Verse 1. It says, "When Isaac was old, he called to Esau his elder son, and said, 'My son.'" And he says, you know, this is a classic thing. "Go out, hunt me some game, make me a dish, bring it to me that I may eat and bless you." And says, Rebekah was listening as Isaac spoke to Esau, his son, and Rebekah said to Jacob, her son. The vision there is quite clear. Isaac favors Esau, Rebekah favors Jacob. And she sets up this whole plan, and Jacob's like, wait, he's going to curse me. How am I going to pull this off? And she's like, trust me, I know what I'm doing. This is probably one of the whole stories that as Latter-day Saints we have a hard time dealing with, because she really is having him deceive Isaac in order to get the firstborn blessing from Isaac. And I have no easy way of, you know, trying to explain that, but it's what happens. And furthermore, you have it's the deception is you know, Isaac apparently is blind or near blind, and so she actually has Jacob put on Esau's clothes. She puts goat skin on the back of his hands and his neck. She fixes the thing, and you have what's actually, it struck me listening to this on my way up here, you have something that has an interesting faint echo of the temple here. Because he wants to feel his hands, he wants to hold him close, he actually smells him. There are, and you can probably correct me on this, but there are some Jewish legends that the birthright that Esau sold Jacob was actually Adam's garment from the Garden of Eden. Not that...
I haven't heard that. Interesting.
Oh, well, yeah, basically the birthright that got passed down was Adam's garment from the Garden of Eden, and this is again in Jewish legends. I'm not saying this is what's actually happening in the scriptures, but that's the birthright that he sold, and this is why when Isaac embraces him, he says, see, the smell of my son is like the smell of the field that the Lord has blessed. He's basically smelling the scent of the Garden of Eden. So that's sort of the you know, you have this increasing closeness in these various levels that he finally says, okay, here's the blessing, and he gives it to Jacob. And, of course, as soon as it's done, Jacob immediately takes off, and Esau comes in. And you have Isaac's very upset. Like, wait, but how can this be? I just gave you a blessing. And then he realizes what's happened. And it's very interesting because he doesn't curse Jacob, and he doesn't revoke the blessing.
Yeah.
He just says, I'm sorry, I already gave him the blessing. And Esau says, you know, haven't you reserved a blessing for me? And he does reserve him one, but it's not a terribly comforting blessing.
Yeah.
You know, he's blessed Jacob to be overlord to your brothers. May your mother's sons bow before you. And to Esau he says, by your sword shall you live, and your brother you shall you serve, and when you rebel, you shall break his yoke off your neck. And we have, again, something very, very parallel to what we see in the start of the Book of Mormon. Esau now is going to bide his time, wait for Isaac to die, and then he plans to kill Jacob. That's where we end.
Well, and there's something I think going on here that you brought this up, that, you know, Latter-day Saints, we seem to want to have our ancient prophets be perfect. That, you know, for some reason, we just have a really hard time with them being mortals who made decisions, and not all of them were the best ones. And this is one thing that I love about the Old Testament, is it doesn't pull any punches. It shows the good, the bad, and the ugly. It shows great patriarchs doing dumb things, like Isaac telling the people of Abimelech's people, "Yeah, this is my sister." And he doesn't even have the excuse that Abraham had when he tried that, you know, because Abraham was fairly closely related to Sarah, but Isaac isn't. You know, he can't pull that one. You know, he's just lying straight up. I think that what we see in the story with Rebecca and the way that she hatches this plot is an example of doing the wrong thing for the right reason. Rebecca knew that Jacob was supposed to receive Isaac's blessing. That had been revealed to her by the Lord before her two sons were born. If you go back to chapter 25, verse 23, it says that. So she knows this, and this has been on her mind now for 40 years. And she's been waiting for the moment when the birthright blessing is going to be given over so that she can steer Isaac in the right direction. But all of a sudden, boom, here's the day. And it suddenly sprung upon her. Now, maybe if she'd had more time, it's conceivable that she could have maybe talked to Isaac, changed his mind, you know, worked him up to it. But, you know, she's lacking this opportunity. So it's possible that she just acted quickly out of desperation. Regardless of the shortcomings of the individuals who are involved here, Isaac did affirm the blessing to Esau, and his blessing to Esau that Jacob would hold the birthright and the blessing. And he could have revoked it and given it to Esau, but he chose not to. And the text doesn't say why, and it is a bit odd that he just says, I said it and I'm done, and okay, I'll give you a blessing, but it's not nearly as good as one you both got. He may have realized, and the text doesn't say this, I'm just speculating, he may have realized, maybe perhaps by revelation, that Jacob was the correct choice after all. But no matter what, these circumstances resulted in tremendous suffering for everyone involved. And we see in verse 41 of chapter 27, Esau swore that he would take Jacob's life once Isaac was dead. This is the same thing that we saw with, you brought up Nephi and his brothers Laman and Lemuel. As soon as Lehi is dead, Laman and Lemuel are like, okay, now, you know, we were holding off because we respected our father. Now he's dead. I think we need to kill Nephi. It's, you know, his time's up. We get that same dynamic going on here. And so there's this division, this enmity between the two brothers for the next 20 years. And it's so bad that Rebecca has to convince Jacob to flee to the home of her brother Laban in Haran, back where Eleazar had found her 60 years ago, to avoid Esau's wrath. And the sad thing is that Rebecca died while Jacob was away. He never saw her again in this life. This is, you know, this is a negative example or a negative instance of what came out of this. Ultimately, Jacob was the one who was supposed to get the blessing, but everything else surrounding this just almost destroys the family because she went about it this way. And maybe she didn't have any other choice, but it's so raw. It's so human. That's why I love this story so much, because, you know, we see this kind of thing in our own lives, that, you know, how many of us have made bad decisions in the way that we have interacted with family members that have caused rifts. And sometimes you do something because you think you're doing the right thing, you know, maybe standing up for what you believe or defending the gospel with family members who are not believers and so forth, but it ends up causing this huge rift. And nothing but an argument, and no one talks to each other for years and years and years. These ancient people, they were just like us in that respect. It's so raw. I love it.
That actually ties, and something I think that ties into well. In the Book of Mormon, we have Nephi through 1 Nephi, and then the first few chapters of 2 Nephi, basically recounting the history up to the time he's making the plates. And there are a couple of things I've always found interesting. The first is Nephi in 2 Nephi records everyone's patriarchal blessings but his own. There's no place where you have Lehi pronouncing any kind of blessing upon Nephi. He does it for Laman, for Lemuel, for Sam, for the sons of Ishmael even, for their children. And I am sure that Lehi gave Nephi a blessing, and it was probably a wonderful blessing, and it probably made it clear that he would rule over his he was the prophetic heir of and actually the ruling heir of Lehi and so on. Nephi doesn't record it, and he sort of gets caught up to date on the plates in his history, and then it suddenly breaks off sharply, and you have what we usually call Nephi's Psalm. And Nephi's Psalm is actually a rather, for lack of a better word, it's rather dark. It's not Nephi exalting in anything. It's Nephi saying, you know, why do I do all these problems? You know, he talks about why should I
yield? I want to be righteous, but I'm not.
Why should I yield to sin because of my flesh? Why should I give way to temptation? Why am I angry because of my enemy? Why should my heart weep and my soul linger in the valley of sorrow because of mine afflictions? And I've often felt that that's the reason we get that right there at the end of 2 Nephi 4, is he's brought it up to date, and he's just finished saying, yeah, and we had to flee because my brothers wanted to kill me. And I think all the loss and the division, exactly what you're talking about, and this division, which Nephi knows prophetically, is going to go on for generations and ultimately end with the extinction of his seat, at least as a separate people. I think that a lot of that Psalm of Nephi is him just feeling overwhelmed. You know, I tried to do the right thing. Because, as again, a number of scholars have pointed out, and you can see by reading, a lot of what First Nephi and the first few chapters of Second Nephi does is establishes Nephi's right to rule, his obeying the Lord, his obeying his father, the Lord supporting him over his brothers. I think it was Noel Reynolds who basically said, this is a political document where Nephi is in essence saying, okay, this is why I am Lehi's heir and successor as prophet and ruler. And he gets up to 2 Nephi 4 and they flee and his heart is broken. His brothers want to kill them. And by the time he's writing this, they've actually been at war with each other for about 10 years. And to your point, we do tend to sort of say, well, you know, if they're prophets, they must have done everything right. And even Nephi makes it very clear that he feels very inadequate. He's very unhappy with his feelings. He's unhappy with some of his choices. Even as he spent, you know, the everything up till now arguing to why he did things right and why he accepted what his father had to say and his own glorious visions and the Lord showing forth his power in Nephi and so on. In the end, I think there's still a bitter aftertaste in his mouth. You have this division, you have this hatred, his brothers towards him, Sam, and all who have followed Nephi. You have warfare, and he knows full well there's never going to be a final reconciliation.
Yeah,
he knows in the end his seed will be, you know, as defined, will be wiped out. They'll be absorbed into the Lamanites, and the phrase "eternal hatred" keeps showing up, and so it's. It's very interesting because I saw someone on Quora ask a question. And I think they were I'm pretty sure whoever was posting this was an LDS, or if they were, they weren't terribly knowledgeable. But I think they were posting it sort of referencing the three Nephites and some of the other early church leaders said, how can someone who had a, you know, early members of the Church of Jesus Christ, Latter-day Saints, who had Testimonies of the Book of Mormon then conclude that Joseph Smith was a fallen prophet. And truth is, Joseph didn't do everything right. The Interpreter Foundation movie Witnesses is actually remarkably frank about some of Joseph's choices and some of the impact it had on those around him, including the three witnesses.
Yeah. And, yeah, if you watch the movie, the Interpreter film Witnesses, it goes into that in great detail.
Yeah.
In fact, when I was watching the movie, and I really liked the movie, I'm not by any means disrespecting the movie, but it was kind of a warts and all approach. I mean, we are just going to, you know, throw everything out here and show how human these people were.
Yeah.
And it really did a good job of doing that. And that's how, you know, a lot of these things in the scriptures are, despite our desire to wish that Joseph Smith was perfect or Nephi was perfect, yeah, or Jacob was perfect.
Or Brigham Young.
They weren't. Or Brigham Young, yeah.
And but the point is that the Lord works with all of us. And he works with what he has. And we don't do things perfectly. That's true top to bottom. But his promises are sure. And his covenants are sure. And it's one of the reasons, I think, why we've had this strong emphasis over the past decade or so to get on and stay on the covenant path. That is where our safety lies, doing things that we need to be doing to live up to our covenants and to persevere even when things go bad. And it's, again, as we've mentioned this in some previous shows, I find it interesting how much over the past several years, especially since President Nelson became president of the church, how much we have members of the First Presidency, including President Nelson, and members of the Quorum of the Twelve saying, we are preparing for the Second Coming. A lot of things are going to happen. Yeah. We need to be prepared. We need to be, you know, we personally need to have that relationship with our Father in Heaven, Savior. We need to have our feet firmly planted on a covenant path to get through the things that are ahead. And I think that's one of the most important messages. You know, it's imperfect, and by the way, I love the Old Testament for exactly the same reason. It's remarkably remarkably frank about the failings of some of these people, and that's what makes it so so relevant.
Yeah, because wait till we get to Genesis 38.
Sorry?
Wait till we get to Genesis 38.
Yeah. So this is where we need to. This is why it's good for us as a church to study the Old Testament, to listen to it, to hear the stories, and to recognize that the Lord is going to be patient with us and is going to continue to work with us. And that we need to be patient with everyone else. Of course, I'm now just about at the...
Oh, there it is.
Anytime now.
No? Yeah. Okay.
There it is.
See you on the flip side.
See ya.